the ethical conduct that we try to apply, accomplishing what's good through the practice of metta, amongst others, purifying one's own mind, which is the insight practice, the practice of vipassana. Most of us come to meditation, I think, because of an interest in mind development. There's a sense that we may wish to purify the mind and succeed. And so it's important to question, what does it mean in this context of practice? How do we learn about our minds, and how do we develop wisdom? Tonight I'd like to talk about working with thoughts and emotions, because I think that from what I heard today, there's still quite some misunderstanding or maybe confusing, and it's quite normal. So the attempt tonight is to try to give a little bit of clarification in relationship to this realm of thought and emotion. We've talked about a lot, and I've always used the word understanding, and it's quite important to understand that the word understanding here has quite a precise meaning, which is intuitive understanding or penetrative understanding. You hear me in the back? Yeah? Oh, okay. And that understanding comes from a relationship with which is not only conceptual. The Buddha talked about three types of wisdom. Wisdom that comes through knowledge. Knowledge that comes from outside, meaning that if we read a book or if we hear a teaching, just like now, it's knowledge that comes through other beings, right? Quite easily, we understand that. Maybe we came even to this retreat through the reading of a book that was insightful and maybe interesting and thought, okay, we need to put this in practice. So this is the first type of knowledge that the Buddha talked about. The second type of knowledge is reflection, which means that we try to understand, we figure out what it means, what we've read, and we do some kind of reflection, which is completely normal. You can say that metta is a kind of knowledge that comes through reflection, the second type of knowledge. The third type is insight knowledge, which is penetrative understanding. The first two are solely conceptual, meaning that they arise and they happen through thinking. The third type, which is insight knowledge, does not come from thinking, but comes from intuitive understanding, or penetrative wisdom is the word that's mentioned usually. So this is done how? This insight knowledge, the vipassana practice, is established by really giving ourselves, offering ourselves that quality of basic awareness that we've been talking about, the mindfulness. Mindfulness to see clearly what is emerging when it is emerging. One teacher summed it up in a very nice way, I think, which is knowing what's happening when it is happening. But the knowing that we are manifesting here is not a knowing equivalent of thinking. It's much more basic than that. And that's maybe where the confusion comes. Because with our scattered and restless minds, we are conditioned to live in our world of thinking. And mostly very educated for most of us, we're trained as small children to name things, to label things, to have a sense of understanding, which comes from the thinking mind. And so the understanding here with mindfulness is much more basic than elaborate thinking. And so when we say knowing what's happening when it's happening, which is mindfulness, that knowing comes through being in the presence of five physical senses, which we all have, right? There's quite easy. There's tasting, touching, smelling, hearing, seeing, feeling. Okay, touching and feeling being the same, feeling body or having a sense of touch in the body. Five sense doors. And then the sixth sense door is the world of mind, which we can contract as thinking, but there's also the whole realm of emotions, which can be sensed. And what's so fascinating is that the Buddha, in relationship to thinking, gave it just the name of the sixth sense door. It's exactly the same, and mindfulness or liberation or wisdom can happen exactly in the same manner when there's the presence of mindfulness in relationship to tasting as in relationship to hearing or seeing, in hearing, just hearing, and tasting, just tasting. That is the quality that we are nourishing every moment. When we mean hearing, is just hearing. And so I'd like just to demonstrate a little example here. It was helpful to me, so I'd like to offer it to you. Maybe it will be of help, maybe not. It's just a little experiment, you know. When you hear the bell, what's happening? There's a vibration that is contacting your ear door because there's a physical body, there's simple contact, right? And the sense door, which I just named hearing, manifests. Okay? You do not need to think to hear this sound, do you? Now, at the end of the sitting, most of us, when we are in contact with this sound, immediately have the thought, ah, the bell rang. Finally, I can get up. Okay? Most of us probably didn't have a moment where this mindfulness of hearing was just apparent. We overlay the thought, the bell rung, right? So it's not that we shouldn't have the thought. It's mostly what happens all the time. We confuse, okay, an experience for another because there's an overlay. Because we're so used to be living in our thinking mind that we don't hear the bird. And just the sound. We think, oh, there's a bird, right? Oh, there's an airplane. And we're really living at the level of thinking. We miss the experience, the actual experience of pure, bare mindfulness. And so the whole process here is to really allow ourselves to know what is happening in the moment when it's happening. Now, Please try to not hear this bell. Can you not hear the bell? No, right? Because we have a sense door, okay? So it's just so extraordinary to be able to have this capacity of extraordinary living being that doesn't have only one sense door, which is the mind moving about, but that we have a reference to all these other types of experiences. And so we're not cutting down the thinking mind, but we're more elaborating, if you want, a spacious living from which there's a sense of wholeness. And that's the reality of being living in awareness. That when you're doing the walking meditation, right, usually, very often, it's going to be our head walking. You know, how many times have I seen myself even leaning forward instead of having the feet, that felt sense of feet walking, allowing just to feel the sense of felt sense. Okay, so that's a really, I think, important issue. And one of the great misfortunes of being a human being is how much, and I think, I remember on my first retreat, it was just so amazing how much I was suffering just being at the mercy of my mind. Incessant thoughts, incessant emotions, you know, obsessive desires, wanting, huge like that, chaos, turbulence, sometimes paralyzing fear. You know, that's what happens when we begin to be in contact with ourselves. But one of the great blessings, you can say, of being a human being, which we have the capacity, is to be able to work in a way that we are seeing and freeing our mind from the suffering. We can work with these minds. What other categories of beings, and not really so far, you know, animals, don't have that possibility. So it's extraordinary to be able to have that capacity. And so two major ways, I think, to work is to see how we relate to thoughts and emotions. And those are the two ways, the main doors where suffering can be created, and there's also a possibility of freedom from suffering. We create whole worlds and universes in relationship to how we inhabit, which has nothing to do with the reality of living the moment. I'm reminded just now of this wonderful artist who painted a tiger on a wall. And he painted that tiger so precisely, so refined, that when he had finished his work of painting, that artist looked at it, at the tiger, and ran away because it was so real. It looked so real to him that he got scared. But he had painted the tiger, right? So this is exactly what is happening so often in our own minds. We paint so many tigers. And then we get scared. We don't know, you know, how to see that the tiger is just a painting. So we live in this world of construction. And yet, we know so little about it. There's such a sense of creating all these mini universes. And it's important to question, you know, are they real? Are these thoughts real? I remember on a very long retreat that I did in Burma, my teacher was Sayadaw Upandita, who you may have heard of, who was quite a fierce master, very demanding teacher, and he had no compromise. You know, you came with something and he was just right there on the point, a little bit like a Zen master with a stick, except he didn't have any stick, he had words. And, you know, I was really trying hard to work very well. And one day I was just expressing what was happening. And he just came to me and he said, you know, you're not here to make your mind quiet or peaceful. And my eyes went like that. I said, no, isn't this about, you know, finding peace? And he said, no, this is not the way to freedom. You're here to understand your mind and its workings. And I left that room that day and I said, oh boy, there's work to do here. You know, but I took the teaching to heart, the advice to heart. I really was determined in a way to understand what this teaching meant. I had no idea what he meant by that, but I took it to heart. And so I said, well, okay, let's look a little closer rather than trying to avoid all those thoughts that were manifesting. Let's look a little closer. What I saw wasn't very nice. Really, there was a lot of criticism, judgment, guilt, the whole turmoil of emotional, you can say life was manifesting through looking a little closer at the thoughts. But I had read a quote that I'm going to read to you. This is a little bit linked to kind of the consequences of my own path. It's a quote from Bhante Gunaratana, who is a great master from Sri Lanka, who is 82 years old, that I met just the other day. He was visiting in Geneva, and he's written books. And this is his quote. He says, somewhere in this process, you will come face to face with the sudden realization, shocking realization, that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels, barreling pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. No problem. He says, you are not crazier than you were yesterday. It has always been this way, but you never noticed. Now, at least, you know it. So we can really sense, you know, how our minds can go in so many different directions and have that craziness inside. But this is what sometimes we need to work with. So when we begin, we have a hard time just staying with that, those mind states and with those thoughts, if that is happening. And we have a hard time understanding and integrating the fact that meditation is not about thinking or analyzing or figuring out why we are crazy or, you know, what we can do about it. This is not the type of work we're going to start digging and look for the history. You know, if I think this today, maybe at 5 years old, I had this and this and this, and then, you know, my upbringing. This is done probably in therapy work. In the meditation, we do not try to find why. It's much more bare and immediate than that. There isn't the problem solving that we may tend to want to do. And so, as someone was saying today, but this is too simple, you know, just staying with a thought and noticing it and not do anything about it, you know, what's the point? Well, I think it's really helpful to understand that the liberation, the understanding, that insight knowledge, which is vipassana, comes from another means. There's another thread that is manifesting. And maybe a thread that we don't quite know about, you know. But insights really happen without us having a construction of how we get there. And I think it's important to understand that, because then maybe we give ourselves a little break around wanting to understand through the thinking or trying problem solving. Problem solving and trying to figure out will only make you feel less stable and certainly more restless. So there's a real interest here to understand how it is that insight is happening. How is the understanding happening? We slowly come to understand that we're establishing a really new kind of relationship, which is one of direct experience. And when we talk about direct experience, it means from the place of awareness. Experiencing from the place of that wholeness that I was talking about, the whole body-mind experience, where there's tasting, touching, smelling, seeing, all of those experiences, within which also when there's awareness, sometimes or maybe a lot of the time, there's going to be thinking. One of many experiences in the field of awareness, of being here now. So there's a bigger perspective from which we work from. Yeah. So when we say, how do we learn here, then? Well, the learning is all about not getting caught in the content of the thoughts. And that's where it's a whole different perspective. We are not so interested in the content, in the story. And of course, most of us, when we are in relationship suddenly with ourselves, you know, what do we look and how do we see? We look at the story. Okay, what is the story telling me, right? So here it's much more being interested at the level of process. And that's how the process, we look at the process of not getting caught and not pushing them away either. Not getting caught, what does that mean? Because that may be not very precise. What it means is not getting involved in the story. That's not very easy to do, right? So we're here to practice to learn. I mean, this is the practice. This is, we start where we are. And how is that possible, you know? Well, we really should not think that the thoughts are bad. Because when you hear me, then you think, okay, thoughts are bad, you know? I shouldn't get into the story. And so immediately we think that they're hindering the practice. And that's not what we're talking about either. If we think that they're hindering the practice, we're giving them much too much credit, actually. We're fueling the thought in a way, you see? So we don't follow them, and we don't avoid them or push them away. Wow. You know what's left? Well, what's left is exactly what I'm sure you're going to know. Be mindful. And that's not an ordinary relationship that we have with thoughts, right? And it's different because we pay attention in a different way. That is what is meant by being mindful. We are paying attention to thoughts in a different way than the ordinary way that we know. Because we spend most of our life in thinking. Here, There's a sense of greater spaciousness because we strengthen awareness, and slowly, slowly, we have the capacity to begin to see a thought for what it is, just the thought as a thought, and not be so in it. Master Dogen says this. He says, coming, going, the water birds don't leave a trace, don't follow a path. Coming, going, the thoughts don't leave a trace, don't follow a path. And if we're really in contact with our moment-to-moment experience, there is a point, and many of you have said this, you know, there's a moment where suddenly you say, oh, a thought. As soon as I want to see the thought, it's gone. A lot of you have expressed this, and it's quite amazing that it's that, just that. We notice them, they're here, they're gone. We allow them to be present, we let them be, we let them go. It's part of the process, part of the show. Sometimes, no doubt, the story will be very catchy. So it's very different than to indulge in the story or want to get rid of the story. So that is really how we relate to thought will bring much more understanding about them, rather than having a picture where they really take the whole field of experience where you don't even know what's happening because you're so in the story. It's now beginning to be a quality of awareness or mindfulness where we understand the nature of a thought. What is a thought? You know, so many sutras and so many stories from the Buddha say a thought is just a bubble in a stream or like a cloud in the sky. It has nothing to do with the nature of awareness. A thought is just a momentary appearance. That's what they say in Tibetan Buddhism. You know, an appearance just like a cloud, it comes and goes. It's like a rainbow. And yet, they have so much power when we give them the belief that we think they have. And so we begin to look. The thoughts begin to be so insubstantial that, in fact, yes, when they arrive, and we're there, there's awareness, they're gone. And it's amazing when there's that beginning of relationship to see that they don't have so much solidity. But when they're not noticed, they shape our entire world. And it's quite amazing how much creation we can have around the universe of thought, you know? I was on a retreat for a few months, and then out of retreat, and a friend told me, why don't we go see a movie? And I thought, oh, no. A movie after so many months of retreat, I don't think I want that experience. Not right now. And then I thought, but you know, in that retreat, how many movies did you create in your own mind? Might as well enjoy a real movie, which doesn't have more reality than the thought that I had. But so I did go, and I was watching that movie, still with my meditative mind state, you can say, or experience of retreat. And it was totally amazing to say, what if they changed the movie every 3 minutes, you know? There was a movie and then another story and then another story and then another story. And I thought, but that's exactly what was happening in my retreat. You know, one moment I was in New Delhi and the other Bodh Gaya and then the Dalai Lama and then Geneva and the family. And I thought, amazing. It's just extraordinary. All these different stories that could manifest on the screen. And that's pretty much what my retreat had been, that retreat. And I thought, wow, how fascinating. But so you begin to realize, you know, that the belief and the reality that we're giving them is completely absurd. And it's fantastic because that is free, you know, when it begins to be an experience that one is living. That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's not, oh, you're hearing me and you say, you know, you've had the thought, oh, that would be nice, you know. It's a living experience. That's what we talk about, direct experience of meditation, where you really see a thought for a thought. So the Buddha explained that phenomena of, if we're not present and we're not really in relationship to what is happening, there's no doubt that one thought will lead to another thought, to another thought, to another thought, which creates story, and then stories that we believe in. He called that, I love the word, papancha. And papancha is exactly what we're doing all the time. It's mental proliferation or elaboration. You know, one thought triggers another thought, and it's amazing because it can be really out of the blue. You start, oh, that little pain in my hip. Oh, I had it yesterday. Oh, but yesterday it really got worse. I wonder if today is going to get as worse as yesterday. But you know, in my family, they all had hip pain. And even my great aunt, she had a hip replacement 3 months ago. I wonder if in the family there's going to be a way that we're all going to have hip pain and we're all going to end up in the hospital like my great aunt did. And then where could I go? Which doctor could I see? Maybe I should go to that hospital. No, I think the doctor. And you're on your cushion and you're creating this whole story, which has nothing to do with the reality of that little pinch in the hip. That's papancha, right? It's proliferating. And what does it do usually when it proliferates and thoughts do that? It creates emotional states, right? Then we feel, oh my gosh, I can tell you when I was in the hospital and trying to, with my hip replacement. And suddenly what brought me back from the story was, you know, the heart bouncing and the anxiety and the pressure and the contraction in the chest and, yeah, emotional anxiety. Thoughts, are, when they're sticky and when they have that capacity to really take you into universes, usually may bring up very strong emotional states. And so why do we need to really try to work on our mind is that if only we had the capacity to have only pleasant thoughts, you know? And of course we do. Some of us, you know, are very experts at pleasant fantasies and, you know, creations where it's only pleasant and it's a way to be avoiding maybe the momentary reality. But often, a lot of the thoughts are not pleasant. And so they create suffering. And yet we may believe those thoughts are the reality. So that's papancha. I don't know if this example will work, but it says we get this big ball rolling about something or the other, and we're suffering immensely as if all's happening right now, right? And it's a bit like a snowball, you know? It's as it rolls, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And Tenzin Palmo, the Tibetan teacher, says this: when we rush in with this mental chatter, we're no longer being mindful. We are just thinking about being mindful. Mindfulness is not thinking about. It is being present and actually knowing in the moment without any mental commentary. If commentary begins to happen, we need to notice it in the moment. There are so many things happening in our lives that we are never really experiencing. We experience only ideas. interpretations, comparison. We dwell on things that happened in the past or anticipate future events, but we almost never experience the moment itself. It is for this reason that we often find our lives boring and meaningless. What we need to realize is that this sense of meaninglessness does not come from our lives, but from the quality of mindfulness with which we live our lives. It's such a great statement, so simple. What she says is that we're just not in connection because we all ready, want more, want other, and yet we're missing the present moment. And that's why we find our life so meaningless and so boring. And so the whole work here is about really making it so much more simple for ourselves in a way. It's simplifying. So it's not getting more. It's much more, you know, letting go, letting be and letting go. And I think Charles mentioned this, but someone asked me again this morning the quote, and I didn't have it, so I'm going to again say the quote from Mark Twain, who says, "My life has been filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened." So we want to learn how we don't get hijacked, you know, by our thoughts in this manner. And so what does mindfulness do? I mean, basically, what it does, quite frankly, is break the chain of habit. That's what it does. It breaks the chain of our patterns, and it helps us just be aware more and more in the present moment and feel and live our life with a greater appreciation for what is. Mostly that's what's happening. And so if you've broken the chain of habit pattern and you've had one moment, one glimpse where you've had this quality of momentary presence and you didn't need anything else and you were just there and connected and appreciating life, you can be happy when you leave. Because that one moment really has a huge effect in relationship to breaking that chain of habit. And the more we're going to break that chain of habit, the more there's going to be the taste, the real taste. And when I'm saying taste, it's really direct experience of what it means to be able to appreciate this moment without needing it to be different. That's immense, huge. So you may say, well, it's not much. And yet, in our reality, it is huge because we begin to understand that being in our body, staying at home, is where we will find the happiness that we so deeply yearn for, and the peace and the well-being. Not somewhere else. In another realm with another fantasy and another dream and another. We start by that direct experience, that mindfulness, to really understand that it's not about what we get or how we get it or the other person, how they behave with me, but much more in the way that we relate to ourselves. And so, if there is a thought and a story, we can just say, okay, this is a thought story. Here's the story. One again. Oh, I know that one. And usually we don't have so many new stories. They're pretty much the same all the time. You know, I'm amazed that we don't get bored with our stories because, you know, for myself at least, there are often so many that are similar to the ones I had before and the ones I had 10 years ago. It's amazing that they can still trick us, you know, or trick me. Maybe I should talk about myself. I can't talk for you, but you know, how much they They have an impact. It's amazing. So we don't have to get entangled in them so much, you know. And we shouldn't underestimate the power of this. So I will say a few words from my teacher that I'm studying with actually, who's Saira Utejiniya from Burma. He says, when the mind is thinking or wandering, just be aware of it. Thinking is a natural activity of the mind. You are doing well if you are aware that the mind is thinking. If you feel disturbed by thoughts, or if you have a reaction or judgment of them, that is where the problem lies. The wandering mind is not a problem. Your attitude that they should not be around is the problem. So understand that you have just become aware of some functions of the mind. These two are just to be seen for what they are. Thinking is a mental activity. You should not try to watch thinking continuously. Neither should you try to avoid observing your thoughts. Wow. What to do? When you realize that you are thinking, pay attention to the thought first. Notice that, know that you're thinking, and then remind yourself that a thought is just a thought. If obsessive thinking is manifesting, which can happen, when a thought keeps growing, no matter how much effort you put into trying to simply notice it, you are probably somehow involved in the thought. When this happens, when thinking becomes so incessant that you can no longer watch the thoughts or notice the thoughts, stop looking at them and begin to feel the underlying emotions that are present in the body. So this is a really important point here. A few of us, or quite a number of us, can say that they have obsessive thinking, right? Where really you can give the instruction of not avoiding, you know, not pushing away, not getting involved, just being mindful. And, you know, there's 1 second, it's possible, and then the story is just too obsessive. And it takes you. It really is getting involved in a way that you're fully taken with it. If this is so, at least for myself and how the Saito sees it, is that there's an emotion which is fueling the thinking process. Something underneath there is cooking or fueling in relationship to emotions. No doubt. So rather than trying to just work at the level of, at one level or one layer, which is the level of thought, it's very, very useful to then check it out and really check not only your attitude, but to see if there is the presence of some emotional states. It can be that with emotions, you know, we usually drown in them, meaning that we're completely invaded by them and get lost and we suffer unnecessarily, or we avoid them. And the avoiding them is really that agitation that is created in the mind, where there's restlessness, because we don't want to approach our emotions. There may be the presence of fear, there may be the presence of anxiety or worry, to come closer to what is present in the body. And therefore, the whirling of the mind, the working of the mind, just covers over and has a layover in relationship to something which is emotional. And so it's really important to know. So when we don't drown in the emotion and we don't try at least to not avoid them, what is the third option? It's, again, to bring some mindfulness to what is present. there's no way that the mindfulness in relationship to emotion is going to be more scary than avoiding or drowning in them. And that, of course, is again a learning process where you really try to be in relationship with these in a balanced way. And that's exactly when it's totally appropriate to have a sense of anchor, as we've said, with the hands, or a sense of body awareness where you feel your ground of body, steadiness, stability, and you really have a sense that you work it a little bit with the emotions and you are receptive and open to have a sense of neutral feeling in relationship to an area which is more quiet, more stable. And so, you know, you work like that. And it's very important then on retreat, usually you are in the presence of a teacher. So there's no doubt that in those moments, it's extremely helpful to ask for help. So it's also completely fine and it's appropriate to turn the attention at times and investigate the emotion. You know, what is an emotion? Well, for me, I mean, I really clearly see that it's a constellation of thought and bodily sensations. Sometimes these emotions are very physical, sometimes they're not, and, you know, there's just a story, which is fear. And we can see that at times they are really trapping us, you know, how much they are trapping us, how do they arise, how do they pass. But again, if there's a quality of interest, of curiosity, we'll have that ability to be a little present, a little mindful. And that mindfulness makes us discover that it's not such a problem. Because even these emotions, they are not substantial. They move, they shift, they pass. You know, it's not a solid block. Suddenly, you really come in contact and you see that it's vibration. It's really kind of shifting. So at first, maybe it's not so possible, but we get friendly. And that's exactly where the whole practice of metta can relate and be intertwined with the practice of vipassana. And we maybe don't switch to metta. As I said, it's not about avoiding the difficulties, but we really take that metta-like attitude, which is friendliness, that I talked about every afternoon, to allow ourselves to approach the area, the enlarged area where the emotion is, in a soft and relaxed way. It's just like taming an animal, you know? When you have an animal that's wild, you don't want to go and grab it, right? It's going to go away. And so if usually we don't have so much sensitivity or ability, but if there's interest, there's a way that we can really approach it with softness, with kindness. And it, of course, takes patience, right? Patience, as you know, is extremely important here. So that the emotion isn't contracted, you don't pull away, you're not creating more fear, but, or, you know, an animal or a little child, you really approach it with softness and kindness. And this whole attitude that we've been cultivating with metta, that heart attitude, is completely helpful in relationship to difficult emotions. One step at a time. And if it's too much, you know, if you're kind of present, we know, then we relax back, we take, you know, some sense of stability, we relax, we go for a walk, we even go in nature, you know, we really nourish ourselves. It's all about balance. So this has nothing to do with forcing our way through, which usually we do when we're caught in our thoughts, you know, what can I do to get rid of this? And we won't. We really go in the sense, in the field of learning, gently, gently to work with kindness. And no doubt that the meditation has a healing power. I can say that out of experience. And if you don't know it yet, I'm giving you my whole faith and trust. Had you known from where I started, I'm an example. Maybe one day I'll write the story. But it's true. There's a huge sense of trust that develops in the practice when we're seeing little drop by drop, you know, it really takes time, that we can make friends with our mind and with our heart. And the whole practice is about making friends with ourselves. As one master said, if at the end of your life you've made friends with your mind or with your heart, that's all that's needed. When on your deathbed you'll be there and you'll ask yourself, you know, what have I missed in my reality? What's missing? And you can say, I've made friends with my mind and heart, you know, I'm in peace, you can say. There's no doubt that it will certainly have a sense of benefit. So the whole point is to be interested in the process, as I've explained it quite thoroughly, rather than be so interested in content. Okay? And with the thinking, usually we are completely involved in the content. And so we're not going to be helping ourselves if we purposely, intentionally stay at the level of content because we're confused of what we're working with. The content doesn't have a lot to say here in this practice. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, we shouldn't find solutions or resolve our problems, and there are great ways that we can do that otherwise, okay? So we can understand that emotions are very related to thoughts, okay? And there's a sense that, in fact, we increase our tolerance to what we're meeting. The balance is what is happening, and there's a sense of spaciousness. And so we don't need so much to have things be a certain way. Maybe the emotions, you know, are still present. There are many moments when I'm visited by fear, but fear is just fear, meaning that there's an increase in the awareness and there's a greater spaciousness to be able to be with what is, and the tolerance is completely different from what it used to be. And what does tolerance replace? It replaces resistance. We begin in practice by living constantly, at least that's what I've seen and what I've heard. We live completely in resistance, you know, resist everything. And slowly with the practice, there's a real growing sense of greater spaciousness and tolerance and equanimity, which I'll be talking about tomorrow night. So I'll close with a quote from Rilke. Have patience with everything unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers which could not be given to you now, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday, far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing, live your way into the answer. Thank you for listening.